The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
We've given Daniel the week off, haven't we, Lionel? Because there's not much for you and I to do in this final episode of 2018.
No, well, it's
you're doing the heavy lifting here, aren't you?
Well, it's nearly Christmas. It's Christmas tomorrow, in fact.
Well, yeah, it depends when people are listening, doesn't it?
true.
Christmas might be yesterday.
That's true.
Or the day before that.
Well, the important thing is, I hope everyone, all our listeners and friends of the podcast, I hope they're all having a very lovely Christmas.
Absolutely, yeah. This, though, is an extended chat. It's a kind of social occasion, was it? You and Dan Lloyd?
Yeah, Christmas drinks with Dan Lloyd, really. Although we met up in November in Southampton at a bar restaurant called the Dancing Man Brewery. Not sure whether Dan Lloyd's much of a dancer, so I asked him whether he was much of a dancer. But I know he does enjoy a beer, so I thought, you know, it's a twist on lunch with. We did have something to eat as well, but we talked about his cycling career. People will know him, perhaps now, will know him best as one of the presenters on Global Cycling Network.
And Twitter personality.
And a Twitter personality, yes, indeed. Very dry wit on Twitter, self-deprecating dry wit, and in real life, really. Dan was a professional rider, started out as a mountain biker, and then worked his way up the ladder quite methodically, really, towards a professional contract with the Cervelo test team. Rode the Tour de France, rode the Giro, rode the classics. But as he says in the interview, you know, he made the most of the talent that he had. You know, he wasn't necessarily the best rider in the world. He wasn't the best rider in the world. But he made a professional career as a domestique, really.
Do you think you've made the most of the talent you have, Lionel?
What a question. Probably. Probably. Squeezed every last drop out of it, Richard.
Got you thinking though, eh?
It's a good question though, isn't it? And it's interesting to hear a professional athlete say that, and admit that, you know, they're, because with, particularly in professional sport, elite sport, the idea is that that you should be striving to be the best. But for, well, 90% of the riders, that's not...
But all you can ever be is the best that you can be.
That is... what an inspirational Christmas message.
But it's, you know, sort of related to this, but I remember, I think 2013 Tour de France, when Chris Froome won, and I think David Lopez was one of his teammates, and he really wasn't going very well. And Dave Brailsford told him, all you can do is give us, if you're riding at 80%, give us 100% of your 80%. And it, you know, that's, I think that helped him to really just focus on doing what he could. And if anybody can, you know, look back on their career and say, I got the most out of my talent, I think they can reflect on it with quite a lot of pride and satisfaction, though.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think Dan does reflect on his career with a lot of pride and satisfaction, the fact that he made it to the Tour de France. I remember him saying to me, in the process of writing a chapter for the cycling anthology once, you know, when he said to people, I'm a professional cyclist, the first question people would ask would be, have you ever ridden the Tour de France? And until he actually did ride the Tour de France, he had to say, well, no. And kind of people, particularly in Britain, don't necessarily get their heads around how professional cycling works as a job. And then he went to get his hair cut shortly after the tour that he completed, and somebody said, oh, what do you do? And he said, I'm a professional cyclist. And, oh, have you ever ridden the Tour de France? And yeah, I bloody have. And, you know, that was the goal of to make the most of the ability that he had. And
the hairdresser said, all right, there's no need to swear.
Well, I don't know. Don't know about
but, no, I'm looking forward to listening to this because I haven't listened to it yet. So what unfolds over the next, I don't know, 45 minutes will be interesting, entertaining for me as well.
Might be a bit longer than that.
That's fine. I've got the time. But before we hear from you, Drinks with Dan Lloyd, we're going to say a thank you to various people who have helped us in 2018. As you mentioned, this is our final episode of 2018. It's been a great year, hasn't it, Lionel?
Yeah, I mean, we do say it every year, but it has been our best year yet. And I wonder at what point will we not be able to say that?
Watch this space. No, it has been. I mean, listener numbers are up. We've produced more episodes, and we've had a lot of fun. I think we've, you know, produced some good Friends specials this year as well. We'll talk about the 2019 Friends specials in a moment as well. But we should say our thank yous at this point, shouldn't we?
Absolutely.
First of all, our sponsors, Rafa, our headline sponsor. Now, Rafa have backed us for 2 years. They will back us next year in 2019 as well. And, you know, they are fantastic supporters. They give us the security, really, that enables us to plan and to commit to doing the Grand Tours and other races. And that, you know, they're great supporters. And we're very happy indeed to be linked to partnering with Rafa. So thank you to Rafa. Thanks to Science and Sport. Again, good long-term support from Science and Sport. And they also will be with us in 2019. And not only do they offer our listeners a discount, but they answer your questions as well. And we've got loads and loads of questions still for their Science and Sport experts to get through. If you have a question on sports nutrition, send us it, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And thanks again to Science and Sport for their support. Hansgrohe came on board this year as a sponsor of our Kilometre Zero series at the Tour de France. That was good. Very grateful to them. Hope we can do something with Hansgrohe again in the future. Skoda helped us with our with the cycling podcast Femina and helped us to cover the women's tour with nightly episodes. That was great, and their support was fantastic, and we're very happy also to be part of their campaign to promote women's sport and strive for gender equality in sport. The Economist have been great supporters this year as well, and without The Economist, we wouldn't have had Kilometre Zero at the Vuelta, and also the Explore series, which has been a six-part series in the autumn, and that's been fantastic and really well received. That's been you, Lionel, and Hannah Troop. And thanks to The Economist for enabling that to happen.
Well, they're our sponsors, but we also couldn't make the podcast without our team of regular and semi-regular contributors. Orla Chenoui, your regular co-host on the cycling podcast, Femina, Richard, but has also contributed to Friends of the Podcast episodes and has been, as you would expect of a professional broadcaster, has been a really excellent addition to our live event lineups in the spring and also more recently in Cardiff and London. Francois Thomazeau, of course, is the man who comes in to replace Daniel Freeb at the Tour de France. He adds so much more than just his French flavour. Fantastic to travel with. Always searches out a decent restaurant and keeps morale high with his his easygoing temperament, really. He calms us both down, doesn't he, Rich?
Does.
Rose Manley has become the crucial third point in the Cycling Podcast Feminine lineup. The three of you went off to cover the women's tour, didn't you, Rich, with Orla? And I started to feel slightly threatened by the on-air chemistry between the three of you. I thought perhaps I'm going to get elbowed out in 2019 if things carry on like
this. Watch this space.
Yeah, but I feel like I've redeemed myself. I've re-established myself as absolutely crucial with the with the creation of Explore with Hannah Troop and also Tom Wally, one of our producers. But working with Hannah has been fantastic. I'm not saying that working with you and Daniel hasn't been fantastic. Before you butt in, Richard, but Hannah has really made working on Explore a lot of fun and has brought something completely different to it, and fingers crossed we will be back in 2019 with a second series of Explore. And I can't forget Fran Reyes, who brings energy and enthusiasm as well as expertise on the Spanish cycling scene to our Vuelta coverage, and of course the irrepressible Ciro Scognamiglio, who pops up here, there and everywhere and then dashes off equally quickly at the end of each contribution.
Somebody pointed out recently that we never say thanks in these roundups to the voices that you hear on the podcast introducing our coverage or telling you about our sponsors and so on. So we thought we'd put that right. First of all, Alice Glossop is the regular voice that you'll hear in the regular podcast. Thank you to her. Flavia Capellini at the Giro d'Italia this year gave a real Italian accent to our coverage. Virginie Pierret at the Tour de France, longtime voice of the tour for us. Thank you to her. Ithier Gomez at the Vuelta a España. Again, she's been doing it for a couple of years, partly because she's my sister-in-law. Thank you to Itziar. And Rob Hatch, who is the voice of the cycling podcast Femina, as well as, of course, the pronunciation police on the podcast.
I like how you acknowledge your sister-in-law, but not your wife, Richard. But well, well, that's just
thanks. Yeah. Yeah, well, she's she is. And thanks to her for doing our Tour de France coverage every year. Something she really looks forward to and enjoys and takes very, very seriously.
Absolutely, quite right too. We couldn't produce the podcast without our production and editing team. They get the show on the road every week and every day at the Grand Tours, often working under a lot of time pressure, editing out all of our mistakes, infrequent mistakes, of course, but making us sound more polished and slicker than perhaps we are, and doing so with good humour and patience. The production team of Tom Wally, John Mooney, Adam Bowie, Paul Scoynes, Will Jones, Alex Adey and Matt Field. And over and above production duties, our road captain slash super domestique Jonathan Rowe, who produces the occasional episode, steps into the breach when we've got issues, when we need something changing quickly, but does so much more than that. He runs our social media presence across Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. He creates all of our little promotional clips and videos. He's basically our go-to man for anything technical. He runs the website, he helps us with strategy and planning. And for anyone out there who's a friend of the podcast, if you have any issues adding your feed to your regular podcast app, he is your tech support, and he does that work seamlessly, really, and we couldn't keep the shows on the road without him. So thank you very much to Jonathan and the whole production team.
Jonathan's really our MVP, isn't he, our most valuable player, although vying for that status as well is David Luxton from David Luxton Associates. David, with his colleagues Rebecca Winfield and Nick Walters, look after the business side of the podcast, contracts, sponsorship agreements and so on, and without them, really, we wouldn't be in the position that we're in, and we're very, very grateful to them for all their hard work and patience as well. Thank you to DLA.
You say MVP, most valuable player, but we've got a very flat hierarchy here at the Cycling Podcast, haven't we? You're out in front, Rich, and then everyone else is equally just half a pace back. I'm joking, of course. A big thanks to Audio Boom, who host all of our audio. They likewise, they keep us on the road. Hopefully no one has ever pressed on the play button on their podcast app and experienced a problem. The reliability is fantastic, and working with them this year has been really, well, it's been a great experience, really. And finally, the sounds of the podcast, the music that you hear in the various episodes throughout the year comes to you courtesy of Amalatera at the Giro, Glass Pear, 13 Senses, Santoré, they do the regular episodes in the Tour de France, Mass y Mass are the sound of the Vuelta coverage, and in Explore, if you've heard any of the music coming in and out of the Explore episodes, that's by Moscow Youth Cult. Now, I know our thank yous have gone on a little bit long here, but hopefully our listeners will indulge us and allow us to say thank you to all of the people who have helped us throughout the year, and not least, last but certainly not least, our listeners, and particularly friends of the podcast, whose support has enabled us to make 150 or so free episodes from January to December, and also the Friends of the Podcast specials.
One final thank you I wanted to say was to Richard Williams, the former chief sports writer at The Guardian, film critic, you know, music man. He's a polymath, really, Richard. He's covered the Tour de France a few times as well. Great company as well when he's been on the tour. But Richard was the voice of Jean Bobet. He did the dubbing of the Jean Bobet interview in the special that I did this year. And he did a fantastic job of it. Really helped that episode stand out, I think, and really enhanced it with his dubbing. So thank you very much to Richard Williams. And I should mention that, well, that was our 2018 Friends special, the Jean Bobet one. 2019, our Friends scheme is available again. That's up and running if you want to sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. £15 to sign up for a year of exclusive episodes. You can pay a bit more if you'd like to help support us a bit more. If you pay the highest fee, then you can submit ideas as well and perhaps be a guest editor of an episode in 2019. But we've got up and running with the diary from the Giro d'Italia, recorded by myself, Lionel, and Daniel Freib, and also Orla Chenoui's Women's Tour diary. I think coming very soon, if not already, is the Tour de France diary, and then the Vuelta a España diary. Each of these episodes is about an hour long, but altogether they only count as one episode. So they'll be one of the 11 or so Friends specials released in 2019.
And yeah, we've made life difficult for ourselves. Really, we've effectively written a brand new audiobook for Friends of the Podcast, haven't we? That's effectively what we've done. It's been quite a lot of work, but it's been very enjoyable. I think we all enjoyed writing the diaries for our physical book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, around about this time last year, and wanted to do the same again. And yeah, I think the diary format is it's certainly something I enjoy. Anyway, I quite enjoy just getting my own back on the rest of you in the written word at the end of the year.
That is fun, isn't it? the diaries are great fun. They do allow us to tell a slightly different story of the grand tours, and I've really enjoyed that. A few of you have asked about the book, and we did produce a book in March this year. We're not producing a book for 2018, however we are planning to produce our second book in the sort of autumn, early winter of 2019. That's the plan. We feel that a book about the cycling year is better off coming out in the cycling year before Christmas. So our plan is to produce a second volume of our book towards the end of 2019, but we'll give details of that when we know them. Should we hear your interview with Dan Lloyd, Lionel?
We should. Let's go to the Dancing Man Brewery in Southampton, where Dan Lloyd and I had a Christmassy drink, albeit a little early, and a bite to eat, and talked about his career.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc. The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, here we are at the Dancing Man Brewery, Dan. First impressions?
Well, there's plenty of beer behind the bar, and we've already had a couple, so I'm pleased with this choice. It's good.
You didn't need to admit that. I mean, you could have just said we've just arrived and we're, you know, stone cold sober. But we've warmed up on a chilly night here in Southampton. I thought you'd appreciate the Dancing Man Brewery. Are you a dancer?
No, but I like a brewery. Maybe later. So 2 pints down. If we have another 3 or 4, I think both of us might be on the dance floor later. It's currently 5:30 in the afternoon. No, I'm joking. It's 7 p.m. But I'm pleased with this. I'm pleased with this place. Yeah.
Dan, tell me a little bit. Whereabouts in the world are you from? Because Southampton isn't quite home turf, is it, for you?
No, I was born in Merton, South London, and then when I was 4, my parents moved down to a village called Bransgore, which is not far from where I am now in Ringwood, so it's close to Bournemouth in the centre of the South Coast. But in the meantime, I've been kind of all over the place, as you are when you're a cyclist, but I've sort of come full circle. I'm about 10 miles away from where I grew up, so Ringwood now, Bransgore when I grew up.
And you came into cycling through mountain biking, which I don't know, would you have been able to do that in Merton?
I have no idea. Probably not. Yeah, I started when I was sort of 13, 14, not that long ago, as a mountain biker. And actually, probably about a mile away from where I live right now, there was a place, or there is still a place called Matcham's Market, where they do like banger racing, have a market every Sunday. And they used to have mountain bike races around there. And I, not long after I got my first mountain bike, I had MBUK magazine. And they had adverts in the back for where the local races were, and there was one down there, and that was my first time of not pinning a number on, but putting one on with zip ties onto the front of my bars.
What was it about cycling? Was it the racing, or the freedom of expression, or just the being outdoors? What was it that really kind of got under your skin at the start?
The racing, I think. So I basically had no interest in cycling, and then my best friend when I was about 13, his uncle, who I never met and have never met, he must have been into mountain biking, because he used to give my friend MBUK magazine when he'd finished with it each month. And when I was around his house, I used to look at it and flick through it, and after a couple of months, I thought, I'd like to get a mountain bike. Said to my dad, can I get a mountain bike? And about 8 months later for Christmas, after I'd pestered him for that long, he just decided he would help me get one. I paid a bit towards it. And not long after I got a mountain bike and I was subscribing to MBUK magazine, as I said, they had the races in the back, and I wanted to go and race. And I think, yeah, for me, it was always about competing, even if I was not necessarily that good at the start.
Were you aware of like the elite mountain bike racing scene? Because that would have just... if you're saying you're 13, 14, you're talking 93, 94, kind of mountain biking kicked off in the States in mid to late 80s, didn't it? I mean, I'm going to test my knowledge here of who were the stars of the mountain bike scene in the early to mid 90s. Can you remember?
Well, for me, it was David Baker, Barry Clark, Tim Gould, Gary Ford, and I think that was kind of the main four people, and you used to learn quite a lot about them in MBUK magazine. And certainly I immediately sort of looked up to them and thought, that's, you know, I'd like to be David Baker riding for Rally. And I remember there was a Southern Area mountain bike series in Bransgall, which is the village in which I grew up, which at the time felt like a huge deal. You know, there was a national mountain bike series, and then there was sort of Northern, Midlands, Eastern, maybe Western, I'm not sure, and then the Southern Area mountain bike series. And to have, I can't remember if David Baker came down or not, but certainly there were sort of one or two riders that I recognised from the magazine that competed 2 miles away from where I lived. And that was amazing. I sort of, I looked at them and thought, I really want to do that.
Did you think then that there was a career as a cyclist or a mountain biker?
No, because I wasn't very good. So that first race I did at Matcham's Market, I was 47th out of probably about 65 riders, although it was a youth category and I was technically a juvenile at the time, but they hadn't invented a juvenile category, so I was a 13-year-old racing against under 16s. But I remember the very first race I did, I was thinking, this is just horrific. And I remember it was two laps, and you come through the start finish area, and there was a burger van obviously making burgers, and feeling sick and thinking, why on earth would anybody want to do this? And still thinking that at the finish. And then getting home and looking back at what I'd done and looking at MBUK and thinking, well, when's the next one? You know, it's like cycling as a whole, really, when you're racing. Sometimes it can be nice in hindsight, but it's rarely particularly pleasant when you're doing it.
So what was it? Was it the feeling of kind of hurting yourself that you know, got into your bones? Because a lot of people enjoy that kind of self-flagellation that cycling allows them to indulge in.
I don't know, really. I obviously just I liked competing straight away, and I obviously wanted to get better, and it helped starting in 47th, because each year I made a little bit of a progression, or each month and each year, and that would become top 30, and then I was doing more sort of Southern Area races, and that would become top 20 and top 10. And the thing with mountain biking is, because it's not a time trial, but it's not too far off, like the result you get at the end of a mountain bike race is pretty much where you should be, as opposed to a road race where in a sprint stage you might have been better than the top five on the climbs, but you're not a sprinter at the finish. And I was motivated at competing and getting better, and I soon became quite obsessed with my training and my numbers. And I remember when I was supposed to be doing my A-levels and being in the common room, and I had a cardio sport heart rate monitor. And at that time, you couldn't download it to your computer, but it did record your heart rate at various intervals, depending on how long you wanted to record it for. It might be 1 second or 5 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever. And I remember sort of on school graph paper tracing out my heart rate from an interval session or from a race or whatever by just going through my watch and just going one number at a time and tracing it onto a graph. And I've still got them to this day, I think, up in the loft somewhere. I've got all of my race results and loads of sort of heart rate graphs. And I think I was just into the numbers. I've always been into numbers and wanting to try and get better.
So you were actually analysing your performance, even though the tools you had available were pretty rudimentary.
Yeah, I got a heart rate monitor as soon as I could, and I got a power meter as soon as I could. And I was quite focused on average speed as well for a time when I thought that was, you know, a way of getting better. In fact, I remember because I started as a mountain biker, my first sort of road riding was on a mountain bike. And then I thought, well, I'm going to go get some slick tyres because I can't afford to get a mountain bike, but I know that training on the road is going to help me. So I got some 26-inch slick Continentals and used to have to mount them onto my mountain bike wheels. And it's a story that I've told on GCN in the past, but I went out on these road tyres on my mountain bike thinking, well, I'm going to go out and average 20 miles per hour because I've read in the magazines that that's quite a decent pace, only for like an hour and a half, so 30 miles. And at the time, as a mountain biker, you're not particularly aware of the wind. So I went out and I must have had a tailwind because I'd averaged about 21 miles an hour, 40, 50 minutes into the ride. Turned round and I was on a big open airfield, sort of picket post, Stony Cross area in the New Forest. And I had a block headwind on the way back, and I my average speed sort of ticked down from 21 to, you know, 20.9 all the way down, so it went to sort of 19.7. I was at my maximum and I started crying in the New Forest into a headwind. Tears started rolling down my eyes because I was so focused on averaging 20 miles per hour and I hadn't achieved it.
Is this where your introduction to road cycling came? I mean, when did the Tour de France come onto your radar?
Not for quite some time. I think probably the first tour that I watched, I've got vague recollections of Indurain and watching Gary Imlach present on Channel 4, and then vague recollections of Rees winning in 96. But I don't think it was really until a mountain bike friend of mine that was really into road as well was watched. He was obsessed by Jan Ulrich, and I think sort of 97, 98, those sorts of years, I really started to take more note of what was happening on the road. And by that point, I was getting more serious and doing more road training and started to do a little bit of road racing to complement my mountain bike side of things. And I basically the bottom fell out of mountain biking. When I started, it was a really popular sport, mass participation, lots of people turning up every weekend, quite a lot of people watching the Grundig World Cups on Eurosport or Channel 4, I can't remember where they were now. But actually, I quickly decided that unless you were going to be one of the top mountain bikers in the world, there wasn't enough money for me to make a career out of it. Whereas on the road, it felt like actually you had the potential to make some kind of career out of it without being one of the very best or top five in the world. And so I'd been sort of, in sort of 97, 98, 99, 2000, I'd been combining road and mountain bike, with the focus still being on the mountain bike. But at a point I said, look, the mountain bike's not going anywhere for me personally. I need to concentrate on the road. And so I went over to that.
And what about away from cycling? Were you good at school? You said you did A-levels. Did you have an alternative career in mind?
I probably would have been an accountant. My dad was a chartered accountant. I've always been into numbers. Maths, I've always been all right at. Did my GCSE a year early. And as I'm an August baby, that was when I was 14. And did maths A-level, yeah, maths, physics, geography, environmental science and general studies. And I got accepted to Loughborough and Bath University, and I took a year out to concentrate on cycling, and I'm now 21 years out in.
You've had a 21-year out. Yeah. That's not too bad, really.
No, but it's been amazing, you know. It's been some journey all the way through, and I'm sure everybody that's done anything that like this will say the same thing. University is like an experience, isn't it? And I think you can get that experience doing other stuff. You obviously at university you're trying to educate yourself in a specific subject, and I was trying to educate myself as a cyclist and get better at that. But you get life experiences being abroad and meeting different people and foreigners and even people from the UK that have gone abroad and done the same thing. And I wouldn't change it for the world.
So when did cycling become a career, or you had your eyes on cycling as a career?
Well, I had my eyes on cycling as a career when I was probably 17 or 18, but it felt like a pipe dream then. And it became a career probably when I was 28. And that's, I mean, it was not quite like that, in that I had personal sponsors and people that helped me out for a few years, because I think both they and I sort of felt I can get somewhere if all the sort of stars align. But equally, had it not been for, you know, a chance with a top level team, I could have been 29 years old, married with a kid, and never having really earned any decent money and just starting again, really. That could easily have happened to me. I could have been 29, right, I've got to do something else now, time's come.
But I mean, you were making your way through the ranks a rung and a half at a time, really. It was a very gradual progression up through those ranks, wasn't it? But I mean, at what point did it become a full-time occupation then, if not a career?
Well, when I finished A-levels, I was window cleaning with my sister Carol. She'd set up a window cleaning business, and I did that, and it was really good because I could earn sort of half decent money on a Monday and Friday, and then go out training Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and at the weekend, compared to working in a supermarket or something. It was quite good. And then I went abroad to UBC-Artois through Rod Ellingworth, actually. He got me the place there. Russ had been there after the collapse of Linda McCartney, Russ Downing. And then I went there in sort of June, July. And I guess I was full-time from that point, really. I was there in 2002 with UBC-Artois. No, 2001. 2002, I was with a team called CO Chamalier in the centre of France in Massif Central near Clermont-Ferrand. And then I was with Endurosport in 2003, which was a continental team or third division at the time, and funded by Dave Rayner that year. So I was full-time. When I was sort of full-time professional, it's kind of debatable, you know, but I was full-time from probably about mid-2001. There were always people that were the same age as me that were a lot better, many of whom sort of gave up and fell by the wayside. And I always think, well, actually, they were far more talented than I was and much better bike riders, but perhaps didn't have the perseverance or maybe the ignorance to carry on like I did. There was always, for me, like one or two or three performances a year I thought, I can do this. I've listened to your podcast this year with Colin Sturgis, and I was nothing, like, he was obviously this super talent that was just, the power that he had was obvious to everyone and not something that comes along very often. I wasn't like that. I was sort of, I was all right, and every so often I'd do a race and think, well, actually I was not far off as good as some of the best riders around that day, and I think if I keep persevering at this, then maybe I can make some sort of career out of it. Like I said, I think it was sort of ignorance in some ways, and it could have been a stupid choice in life, really, because I could have been 28, 29 and just having to start afresh something completely different.
You went to Troyes, the home of Andouillette. We'll look at the menu in a minute and choose something to eat here, but did you ever sample the disgusting delights of Andouillette while you were in Troyes? Do you even know what it is, what I'm referring to?
No, I had no money, and so I was rooming in an apartment with Russell Downing, and we had a deal. Russ made the dinner and I did the washing up, because I had no idea how to cook. He used to do like burgers, and I remember we walked down to a Lidl once, when Lidl must have been pretty new at the time, and bought a load of shopping, and we had to stop five times. And it's only about a kilometre away, but we bought so much, and you forget how heavy something is when you have to carry it for a kilometre, when you normally just put it in a trolley and put it in the car. But no, he did the cooking and I did the washing up, and that's how we survived.
Well, Andouillette is, of course, disgusting sausage, which it's basically tripe. So it's stomach lining packed into a sausage. It smells of drain water. It's very unpleasant, but they love it over there. I'm surprised. The air is sometimes thick with the smell of Andouillette in Troyes, but you obviously missed that, and you're very fortunate for that. Was it Rod Ellingworth who set you up? with that, because there's been quite a long connection with that club, going back to, well, at least the 80s, maybe even before.
I'm pretty sure it was. I've not got a great memory, but I'm pretty sure that Rod Ellingworth was basically the guy that got me into UVC Artois. I'd kind of made contact with the Dave Rayner funds to get some sort of funding, or at least just help in finding a place abroad, because I realised that that's what I needed to do to get any further in the sport. And I'm pretty sure it came through Rod, because he'd got his contacts there with Jack and Chris Andre. And Russell was already there. He'd been there from the start of the year, riding really well. And I got there and did pretty shit, really, for a few months.
Well, we'll pick that up after we've had a look at the menu.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, sorry to interrupt your chat with Dan Lloyd, Lionel, but that was the voice of Seb Piquet to remind us to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Beer 52, appropriate sponsor for this week of all weeks. We both took delivery, Lionel, of cases of Beer 52 beers. It's a craft beer club, of course, and they send you 8 different beers each month to a different theme. The most recent one was West Country. We were going to have a refreshing beer as we recorded this bit of the podcast, but I gather you finished all yours.
Well, they did arrive a couple of weeks or so ago, and I've had one every couple of nights, and what I really like is you never know quite what you're going to get. The range and variety is quite something. Every beer has a very distinct and different taste, and what I quite like doing is getting to the end and having given them a sort of a score out of 10, which I preferred the most.
Wow. I just opened a can there as you were talking. I don't know if you heard that. Do you tap the top of a can before you open it? That's just something I do. Anyway, this is a can of Ellensburg Session IPA. All these beers are brewed in the Bristol area. Sorry, this is North Cornwall. I do beg your pardon. It's from North Cornwall. And it's a kind of fruity IPA, and it quite dry, leaves a bit of a tart taste in your mouth, but very nice indeed. Remember this one from your box?
I can. 8 out of 10 for that one. The best one, the one I enjoyed most was, which I wasn't expecting to enjoy, but it was the Wild Beer Sleeping Limes.
I knew you were going to say that, because that's the one I enjoyed most.
Really?
Well, that was delicious.
Yeah, it was delicious. I just thought, I'm not sure about this. I don't know why. I thought it's going to be too citrusy or whatever, but it was really crisp, fresh, and very light. Really nice.
Yeah, very very refreshing. I did worry it might taste like Top Deck. Remember Top Deck? But it wasn't like that at all. It was very very nice indeed. And they are all very different. You know, they range from quite light beers to quite dark beers. I enjoy getting my monthly box. And would you like a free case of craft beer? That's you, the listener. As a listener to the Cycling Podcast, we'd like to thank you for listening. And with the help of our friends at Beer 52, you can claim a free case for just the cost of postage, which is £5.95, as well as the 8 craft beers you get from Ferment Magazine, which tells you all about the beers and is actually pretty interesting. And also a snack delivered next day shipping. That's, as I say, for £5.95, which is the cost of postage. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case, try the beers, see what you think. And if it's not for you, you can pause or cancel any time. Just visit www.beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com/cycle to claim your free case today.
And that's beer52. beer52.com/cycle.
Back to you and Dan Lloyd, Lionel.
Our beer is called Necessary Evil, Dan.
Well, it's nice. You ordered it for me. We went for a sort of lager type beer, didn't we? But yeah, it's good. Good enough to see you on the dance floor a few minutes ago whilst we were choosing. You looked good.
That's an absolute lie. Fake news from Dan Lloyd there. You've restricted me to a main course only, no starters. But you're skinny as a rake, Dan.
Well, I get... We were just discussing whilst you had the mic off, but my appetite has always been the same. When I do a load of exercise, there's often times when I'm not full and I can eat the house. And then it was always the same at the end of every season for me. I'd look forward to those 3 weeks that you had off where you could kind of do what you wanted, drink what you wanted, eat what you wanted. And always after 1 week, I'd lose my appetite. Not completely. I'd have breakfast, lunch and dinner, but in between times I'd look at chocolate and think, I don't actually want that because I still feel full from my breakfast or lunch or whatever it might be. And that, thankfully, sort of happened when I finished my career as well. And also, not only that, my appetite not only dwindled to having the three main meals of the day, but also changed completely. So my entire life I'd craved sugar in any form, so chocolate or cake or sweets, porridge with golden syrup in it or whatever it might have been. I just wanted sweet stuff all the time. And when I finished, when I retired from racing, that completely changed to all things savoury. So rather than craving some chocolate in between a meal, if I did crave anything in between a meal, it'd be like a packet of crisps. And when I woke up in the morning, I'd want like a bagel just with butter, or a muffin with butter on it or whatever, rather than porridge with golden syrup or Alpen with sugar in it or whatever it might be. So yeah, my appetite changed quite significantly when I stopped.
Golden syrup, I mean, that is the hard stuff. Not just honey, golden syrup, goodness me. I mean, that's the sort of thing you put in a Christmas cake or a Christmas pudding, no?
Actually, we still have it to this day. I put golden syrup in porridge. I did it this morning. I make it. I wake up quite early and I start a saucepan of porridge and I put a big dollop of golden syrup in it and stir it in, and we have like cranberries and strawberries and stuff on top of it. So I passed it on to my kids. Tate and Lyle's golden syrup. Is it Tate and Lyle's? That's right, isn't it? One of those massive metal tins. When I was younger, I used to actually just eat it from the tin with a spoon. That and condensed milk.
Oh, condensed milk. I mean, you're a child of the 80s. You're revealing this here. I mean, I'm a bit older than you, but yeah, condensed milk was... it was unbelievable that anything could be that sweet.
Yeah, I loved condensed milk. My dad, I'm born very late into my family, so my mum and dad are a lot older than me. But I understand that he used to make my sisters condensed milk sandwiches. So just two bits of white bread, condensed milk, sort of loving in between. For me, he used to make Cadbury's Wildlife Bar sandwiches. So you remember the Cadbury's Wildlife Bars? Just like really thin bits of milk chocolate broken up into two pieces of bread. Bliss.
Are your siblings quite a bit older than you then?
Yeah, so I've got Carol, Kelly and Jackie, and they are 21, 23 and 25 years older. In fact, Jackie, my oldest sister's got two children, one of whom's older than me. So I was an uncle when I was born.
Wow, I mean, did that affect your childhood at all? I mean, being so much the baby?
No, because for everybody, their childhood is normal, isn't it? So whether you're in poverty or whether you're rich or whether you've got parents that could be your grandparents or parents that were 16 when they had you, I think whatever you grow up with as a kid is kind of normal. It's only when you sort of subsequently look back at that and compare it to, you know, friends and colleagues and how they were brought up is when you sort of realise it was a bit different. But no, it was complete. I mean, it was a bit of a joke at school, you know, why is your grandma coming to pick you up? Because my mum was 53 when she had me. But no, it was just normal. It was just normal.
Wow. I mean, that's quite an age. I mean, yeah, that's quite an experience. But like you say, completely normal if that's all you know.
Yeah, yeah. So it makes you feel quite young to have your first child, Lionel. No, she was, yeah. I mean, she had the Sun newspaper knocking on the door because I think she was like the second oldest mother, basically, in the UK when she gave birth to me. I understand there was one lady in Ireland somewhere that had a baby older than my mum had had. But yes, yeah, I mean... It's only dawned on me since I've been a parent myself that my dad one day came back from work, and my mum, who thought she'd just had rib pain for a while, said to him, "Got a little bit of news for you here. I'm pregnant." And he must have been like, well, I won't swear, but I can imagine what I'd be feeling like if I was 53 and my last child was just about to move out of the house and I was just about to retire and live the good life again. Yeah, must have been a bit of a shock, to say the least.
Fascinating. I mean, I genuinely didn't know that about you at all. And it's funny, isn't it? I mean, you joke there. I mean, I feel like I'm going to be an old dad, but
you are 10 years. Well, you are lying. So you didn't hear that.
Yeah. Oh well. Anyway. Yeah. Oh dear. Let's get back to cycling. Tell me a bit about how you kind of made those steps, because really, if you trace the career through the teams you rode for, it was progression, you know, year by year, steady and slow, but you got there in the end. I mean, the first big team you rode for, I think, was a team run by Harry Lodge. Now, I know who Harry Lodge is, but explain for people who... He's one of those almost semi-legendary names and figures in British cycling, but a lot of our listeners may not know a great deal about him.
Well, a little bit like Tim Harris, who you've had on before as well. Like, you know, there was... Back in the day when you almost had to move abroad to make it as a professional cyclist, there were all these riders, and you knew the Robert Millers and the Chris Boardmans and the ones that really made it to a top level. But for all of those, there were, you know, two, three, four other riders that had gone abroad and actually been a really good rider, maybe not famous, but they'd certainly earned respect of their colleagues in Belgium or France or Italy or wherever it might have been. And so, well, it wasn't a big team. It was sort of the original enduro sport team. So it was my first foray into professional cycling, in that I wasn't paid to ride, but I rode with professional riders. And Harry.
So what was the deal if you weren't paid? What was the deal for you?
Well, I think that was the year I got Dave Rayner funding. So I'd applied for it at the end of my UBC Artois few months. And then I didn't get it. I was a bit disappointed not to get it, actually, but I didn't get it for 2002 when I was in Chamalier next to Clermont-Ferrand. But I did get it the following year with Enduro Sport. So I had Dave Rayner. I can't remember how much it was now. It was about £200 or £300 a month, maybe. But we had a flat over in Italy, not sort of northern Italy, near to Malpensa Airport, in a place called, I was going to say Sacramento then. It's... Samarate was the name, near Gallarate. So we were not far from where Charlie Wigelius was, and in Busto Arsizio. So the accommodation was paid for, so then you've only really got to pay for your food. So £200 or £300 a month was... Well, that's what the Dave Rayner Fund's all about, really, is just allowing you to be there without it, you know, costing you money and money that maybe you haven't got. So I was there, yeah, for 6 months of 2003, and Harry had just retired from the Flanders team, which is where I ended up the next year when Enduro Sport was no more.
Were you comfortable abroad, comfortable in France, in Italy? Did you pick up anything about the culture and the language? And what, I mean, how did you settle in, and what did you take from those experiences?
I settled into... Well, I speak half-decent French, or at least I did when I was over there. I've probably lost quite a lot of it now. In Italy, I have to admit, I was quite lazy because I was only there for 4 or 5 months in the year, and I was with a load of English speakers, and I didn't really make the effort to sort of pick up the language. But I loved it there. You know, Troyes was a really nice place where I was with Russell. Clermont-Ferrand was a beautiful area of the world where I was. John Rutherford and Andrew Jackson had been there before me. And Italy was one of those ones where people said, well, before I went to Italy, I remember a lot of people saying, when you go there, it would be so amazing because the Italians have such respect for bike riders, and it's so different to the UK. And I got there, and honestly, the car drivers were a nightmare. They just, not, I wouldn't say they'd run you off the road, but there didn't appear to be that much respect for bike riders, particularly in northern Italy and Lombardy region, where there's, you know, so much traffic. It was, I'd say it was quite hectic. And actually, Italians are so impatient on the roads and in everything that they do in life, in general, making a generalisation. And the following year, I went out to Belgium with the Flanders team, and it was complete opposite. I lived above a bakery, and you could be in the bakery in a queue of four people, and the person at the front would give their sort of family story to the baker. And everybody in line would just wait there very patiently, you know, waiting their turn, and then they'd get to the front. It couldn't have been more opposite to Italy, where they couldn't wait to get to the front of the queue.
So Belgium left more of a kind of imprint on you. I mean, you love a Belgian beer for a start. You love the Belgian races. What was it about going and living in Belgium, and whereabouts were you?
I was on the N60 main road between Oudenaarde and Ghent, opposite a McDonald's and above a drive-through beer shop, which I actually didn't frequent very much at all. I've always liked to drink, but when I was racing, I managed to keep it to, you know, it's a reward for the end of the season, or, you know, maybe a certain point within the season. It's one of those places where you sort of think, it's certainly not exotic, but as a cyclist, it is quite exotic. You know, that's where so many champions have been made, and there's so many great riders from Belgium, and the people are just so nice and welcoming, and I really love going back to Belgium these days.
How much time do you spend riding up and down the towpath next to the Schelder then? That's the river between Ghent and Oudenaarde, and there's a chain gang that goes up and down there every whatever it is Wednesday morning, and whenever I've been in Ghent, ridden down to Oudenaarde on the I say towpath, but it's smooth tarmac and very popular with cyclists. I mean, you must have spent a lot of time on there.
Well, never with that group. I never went out with the sort of organised ride on that, on the canal. I mean, I was teammates with Stephen Gallagher, who's like my best mate. And we'd sometimes go down there, but you'd sort of search out the climbs as well. And we're in Belgium's like a maze of roads, isn't it? Which is what makes the classic so special in the first place, is that you, if you don't know it, you've got no idea where you're going, it can be incredibly complicated to navigate. But we ended up finding these really sort of nice roads, and you could avoid the cobbles that if you wanted to, which you generally do in training. So we didn't spend that much time on the Schelder, on the canal next to the... But rather, we sort of went into the sort of Flemish Ardennes, and then, you know, around Ronce, when you get into the French-speaking area, there's a few slightly bigger climbs. I mean, they're not mountains by any stretch of the imagination, but they're... Yeah, it was great. I loved it there. I loved Belgium.
And then, I mean, the jump from Belgium to riding for a team that saw you racing in the Far East a fair bit. I mean, what was the... How did you kind of make that leap? What happened?
Well, it was down to lack of choice, really. I did 2 years with the Flanders team and then had nothing at the end of that. And then it was David McCann, the Irish rider that me and Stephen knew, who said, well, why don't you come and race in Asia? It's decent prize money, the races are getting better. And it was kind of, that was the only option, really. I would have liked to probably have stayed in Europe. So I ended up spending, 2006 all over Asia, really. I like the separation between, I was going out to Asia and racing, and I'm coming back and training, but the rest of the time I wasn't, encompassed by cycling.
And you were starting to make some gains at this point, but how long were you going to give it? I mean, it was relatively late that you got what we would say, is now a World Tour level contract, but what were you thinking at that time? One more year, or what was going through your mind?
I have no idea. I'm not sure. Like I said, there was always points where I thought I can do this. Like on my day, I'm not that bad. Like I can compete with some pretty good riders. And I always sort of thought, well, if I did make it, I could be a good domestique, and because I'm good over different types of terrain. But like I said, I think I was a bit. I wouldn't recommend it to everybody. I mean, at the moment, I don't know when this is coming out, but at the moment, James Shaw is 22 years old. He's just been let down by Lotto Soudal. And I have actually messaged him and said, you're so far away. You're 6 years away from when I made it to the top team. And he's obviously got the talent, and he just needs to persevere for another couple of years. And the landscape might change again, and he's going to have another opportunity. And I have no doubt if he does get another opportunity, he's going to get results which show that he is a true cycling talent. But I wouldn't recommend to anyone that you go through to 28 or 29 because you could easily just come back into the real world without anything behind you and no education and just start again and have nothing at all.
It feels like the whole boom in British cycling was a million miles away from you at that time, 2006, 7, 8. But the germ of an idea for Team Sky had been planted. The Olympic success, which had begun in 2000 with Jason Queeley and then Chris Hoy in 2004, and then obviously 2008 was the massive breakthrough year. Did any of that affect your world at all? Did you get a feeling that there was some kind of momentum behind British cycling and British cyclists?
Not really. I mean, if anything, it probably helped me that cycling wasn't huge. I genuinely think if I was 20 years old now, that I probably wouldn't make it as a pro. I think the level's gone up, and I just wasn't. I made the most of what I had, and I was quite an early adopter of power meters and stuff, and I made massive gains through using them. And then I think once other people learned how to do the same thing that were more talented than I was, the gap that I'd bridged suddenly became a gap again, if you know what I mean.
Our burgers have arrived, Dan. They're served in sort of roasting tins. Wrong way round. You're chicken, I'm beef. We probably need to take a break here. We'll resume after we've eaten. You're not a huge foodie, are you?
No, not massively. I like food, but I loved food when I was racing. Like I said, when I had a big appetite, but yeah, not so much anymore.
Well, it filled a gap that, it's left some gaps for the beer to seep into. We've got another glass of Necessary Evil here. We spent two-thirds of the podcast talking about your pre-pro career days, so we should get to the point where you actually made it and how that came about.
Well, I kind of had a taster of top level pro cycling in 2007 with DFL Cycling News, with Nick Collins, who funded that team, who helped me out a lot actually over the years. That year I was with Nico Matta as a teammate, and I got to do like Genwevelgem, 3 days to Panna, and had some really great experiences. And then that team kind of came to an end, and I had nothing by January of 2008. So then I was with the Sean Kelly team, run by Kurt Bogarts that year, which was fantastic, but it was kind of a drop down from Pro Continental to Continental. And sort of the last ditch effort, I guess you might say. Like, I think if that hadn't have materialised into anything else, I would have called it a day. But that was a fantastic year. Like, Kurt's just an amazing... He's one of those guys that you meet and think he's an arsehole, and then if you get to know him, he's just one of the nicest, best people in the world, Kurt Bogarts.
I think the story was that he lived in the same town as Sean when Sean lived over in Belgium, and he basically knocked on the door and asked if he could come training, and Sean said no. And then he came another day, can I come training? And Sean said no. And in the end, I mean, he made such a nuisance of himself that in the end, Sean said, okay, but, you know, keep quiet and don't say too much. And a friendship grew out of that. And I think Kurt would have been, you know, a teenager at the time, obviously a huge cycling fan. And he ran that team really well, and some very good riders came through it.
Well, yeah, he's kind of one of the unsung heroes of the sport, I'd say, Kurt Bogarts. Like, the amount of people that came through the Ampost team or its various incarnations and went on to be World Tour, I mean, you can count them, obviously, but there were a lot of people that went through his team and went on to be pro riders, and you kind of don't get the thanks in cycling, do you, for the development of different riders? And it just means so much to him, doesn't it? I mean, they made some YouTube videos when Sam Bennett won that stage of the Tour of Britain a few years ago, and Kurt could hardly speak. And I saw a photo the other day after Tom Pidcock won the European Championships of Kurt, sort of Tom Pidcock looking fairly cool and Kurt just sort of in tears next to him. And like you said, he's quite a hard, kind of cold guy when you first meet him, but cycling obviously means so much to him and he puts so much into it. And it's such a shame that those developmental teams don't really get more, firstly, recognition, but secondly, funding to keep going, really. You know, they do such a good job for the sport. Anyway, so that was 2008. And towards the end of that year, well, we had a fantastic year, basically. I won a race with the World's Extra Madura, and then Stephen Gallagher won the Ampos RAS, or Ross, as I'm told I'm supposed to say it. And then Dan Fleeman won the Tour of the Pyrenees. And it was a rare thing, I think, for a continental team, because obviously in a continental squad, and to a degree a pro continental squad, everyone's there to make it to the next level. So cohesion's not a big thing, because everyone's out for their own goals to try to make it to their ultimate goal, which is to be in the World Tour. Whereas that year we sort of had this team where everyone seemed to be quite willing to work for each other, even though they knew that they wouldn't necessarily get anything back from doing it. So three of us won different UCI stage races. And for me and for Dan Fleeman, it gave us the opportunity to go to the Cervelo test team, which I got a call about in probably September-ish. I don't know if it was after the Tour of Britain or before it, but certainly around that time. But I was that old by then And I'd had that many sort of broken promises and broken dreams that I got this call about the Cervelo test team and thought, well, that probably never happened, you know, just another pipe dream that will never come to fruition. But it did.
And who was in that team?
Well, me and Dan were the star attractions, and there was also Carlos Sastre. No, it was, I mean, they basically had, they had two kind of marquee riders. So Carlos Sastre, who'd won the Tour de France a few months previous, and Tor Hushovd, who'd won the green jersey at the Tour de France a few months previous. And then they had a load of sort of fledgling pros, you know, the likes of Roger Hammond, Andreas Klier, even Heinrich Hauser to a degree, riders that were bloody good but weren't on the upward trajectory, and if anything were on the downward. So they had these two sort of expensive signings, a few sort of probably half expensive signings that were cheaper than they should have been, and then a load of pack filler, which is what me and Dan were at the bottom somewhere.
But this was a new team, wasn't it? So they had to do something to punch a hole, sign two very big riders, and I guess that swallowed up most of the budget.
Yeah. Yeah, it must have done. And like I said, you know, so I was probably quite lucky that they didn't have a bigger budget. Had they had a bigger budget, they probably wouldn't have needed to fill the gaps at the end of the roster. But thankfully, they did need to do that, and I got this opportunity finally at 28, I guess. I mean, it was basically through Brian Smith and David Harmon and Richard Ulchin, all of whom helped me. And I'm going to mention all of them because I don't know who had the biggest say in my position. But anyway, they all helped me. And I got on this team, and I arrived there in sort of November of 2008. And we had this sort of mini, it wasn't a training camp, it was like a get-together in Switzerland where the team had its base. And I remember arriving there thinking, well, this is happening now. You know, actually big riders were here and the team seemed to be well set up. And I arrived reasonably early compared to the others at the hotel, and meeting Thomas Campana, who was the manager, and his wife, I think, Priska, and saying, you know, who am I rooming with, or where I am, where am I? And they said, we haven't sorted out the rooms yet, but if you go to the last reception, they're probably going to know which room. So I went to the room, and it was about 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'd missed out on lunch due to sort of flying arrangements and been probably too tired to buy a sandwich on the plane. I thought, well, I'm going to dump my bags in the room, and maybe I'll see if the team's going to pay for lunch, or I don't know what the situation. Anyway, I got up to my room, and they put two boxes of Swiss chocolates, like one on each bed. I was so hungry, I sort of opened mine, I just munched through like most of these Swiss chocolates. Left a couple, put them back, went back downstairs, and a few more people had arrived, and then I said to Priska again, you know, is there a team list yet, you know, do you know who I'm rooming with? Because I was kind of just interested to see which professional rider I was rooming with, whether it was Jez or Roger or someone I knew or whatever. And she said, yeah, I don't know who it is, but you go on onto the lift there, there's the list of team riders. So I went over to the lift and looked down, I sort of found my name and room number, and next to it was Carlos Sastre. And I basically thought, hell, I'm rooming with the current Tour de France champion. You know, like, because it has always been my dream to be a part of this. Oh, I was just a fan, really, and to be rooming with the Tour de France champion, I was like, my God.
And what did you make of him?
Well, my first thought was, oh my God, I'm rooming with Carlos Sastre. And my second thought,
I've eaten his chocolate.
Yeah, my second thought was, no, I hadn't eaten his chocolate because he had his own separate ones. But my second thought was, he's going to think I'm so unprofessional that I've munched my way through a box of Swiss chocolate. So I went back up to the room, and what my tactic of choice was, what I'm going to do is I'm going to eat the rest of my box of chocolates, and I'm going to dispose of the evidence in the hallway in a bin, and I'm going to move his box of chocolates from his bed to the desk that's in the middle of our bed, so it looks like we've only got one box of chocolates between us. And that's what I did. And then at the end of that camp, he was such a gentleman that when we were about to leave, he said, you should take those boxes of chocolates because I don't need them. And I said, oh, thanks, Carlos. And I went home and I said to my wife, look what I got you from the airport. So I was a winner. Oh.
Did you feel nervous? Were you just happy to be there? I mean, I can't quite imagine what your mindset would have been. You know, the age you are, looking around, thinking, well, all the other newcomers are maybe 5-6 years younger than me. I mean, did that feed any insecurity? I mean, I'm projecting my own sort of thoughts and personality onto this here. But what were you thinking?
Probably a mix of all of those things, I would imagine. I definitely would have been nervous because I always held sort of great riders in a sort of esteem. You know, I looked up to, but I still do actually. I look up to the best riders because I've got a big respect for what they do. So I would have definitely been nervous being around Carlos or Tor. But then it was such a friendly team so immediately. Like, I don't know what. I mean, you've had people say the same things to you before, but somehow everything seemed to gel very quickly between a huge different level of rider. But we had a real team atmosphere right from the very beginning, and it didn't feel like there were many egos. And it was a different team in the way it was set up. Like, obviously, Gerard and Phil from Cervelo had their experiences sponsoring big pro teams and not enjoyed it or not got back what they thought they should, so they set up their own team with a sort of a load of partners that had an equal amount of stake. I think they all put in about $500,000 each, so like Speed Play Pedals and Zip Vip Food and Vittoria Tires and Rotor Cranks, and we had all these sort of small sponsors that all put a little bit in.
Did you feel a pressure to impress on the first training camp?
I didn't feel pressure from out externally. I felt an internal pressure. But then you sort of quickly realise that, like, in smaller teams, the training camps are like races because you're trying to prove yourself to get a place in the team for the biggest races. Whereas immediately when I got there, I realised that actually the big riders weren't really riding that. They were training, but they weren't trying to. They don't need to prove themselves in a training camp because they'd already proved themselves in races the previous year, and they would be about to prove themselves in races that year. So the training camps had a different aim, I guess, for them than it did for me previously.
That first year you rode the Giro, didn't you? And you must have known, oh, well, there's going to be a place in some of the big races, so you're going to get some opportunities. But what was going to be your role in the team? Did you have an idea of how you fitted in?
Well, I think that was the advantage of being 28 is that you know you're not going to be a cycling champion. At that point, you can say you're not going to be the next Eddie Merckx, for example. And so immediately I thought, well, I'm just going to, if I can just help in lots of different races, in lots of different scenarios, then I can be quite a valuable piece of the puzzle. So I just slotted into that straight away, really, in terms of, you know, I was there to help Tor or Carlos or Heino or whoever it might be. And I did quite well in that first year. I was all right. And so the first race I did was Tour Kata, and we got off to this amazing start. Like, Roger won the first stage. At that point, cycling Tour California was about the same time, and I think actually Tour probably had already won a stage of the Tour California before that. So it was a new team, but we got off to this amazing start, and we had load. You know, most of us were in the top 10 overall at Tour Kata, which is a small race, but it's quite a hard race when the wind blows. And so I think we were all sort of on cloud nine, really, like, right from the very beginning. And that, you know, success leads to success, doesn't it? And we didn't have the biggest budget or anything else, but we were all just loving what we were doing for different reasons, I think. You know, me, because it was my first experience doing that. Roger and Andy, because they got the love for the sport again and they were being successful again. And Carlos and Tor, because, you know, they moved over as team leaders and they had a lot more responsibility, but the success was coming quite immediately, really. You know, Tor was winning in California, he won Het Nieuwsblad in the end of February, and then when we went to the Giro, Carlos was winning stages there, but so was Simon Gerrans and Ignatius Kanovalovas. I know, but we just had this momentum right from the very beginning, and when you've got that momentum, it just carries on, you know. I guess 2011 was the sort of, when we merged with, it was a merger with Garmin, and seven of us, like the core classics group, went over to that, and it was a bit of a mess, really. You know, people didn't find out until late August, and only seven people had a job and everyone else had to go off and find something else. The team was arguably stronger and better on paper, but it didn't gel quite as well, and therefore we didn't get the same results. And then, well, I guess I found out what it's like to be a domestic winning team that's not getting amazing results, because I didn't have a the end of that year for me, which, you know, actually, when I think back about it now, was always going to come, you know, sooner rather than later, probably, because you end up on a salary which is three or four times what a new Neo Pro is going to be on, but you're not actually that much stronger or better. You've got a bit more experience, and you can maybe provide a bit more and give a bit more in races from an experience point of view. But they can nurture a younger rider to that in a year or two, and they cost, like I said, a third of the price. So at the time I was really disappointed, but looking back it was on the cards anyway. I don't know. And then so I had two great years of Cervelo, and I had a decent year with Garmin, which I really enjoyed as well. And that was the end of that, really.
But now you look back, I mean, you got to ride the Tour de France as well. Is that, in hindsight, is that really important to you that you got to do that?
I think so, yeah. I think without that, I might not even be sat here talking to you now. You know, there's been plenty of British pros through the years that have ended up, the Tour is obviously the pinnacle of the sport as a cyclist, and some people go there to try and win it, and I went there to try and get to the Champs-Élysées, which I managed in the last 10 places in the race. But for me, that was like winning it, really. I mean, that's 30 almost. I just never thought I'd ever do the Tour de France at all by that point. It was just a pipe dream, and I got there and I kind of soldiered through, really, because that year I'd done, you know, the early season stage races and all of the classics. Then I did the Giro. And then at the end of the Giro, I remember saying, do you want to do the Dauphiné? And I thought to myself, well, I'll give it a go, because I know a lot of riders say that they come out of the Giro quite well after 6 days of recovery. So I had 6 days off. I went to the Dauphiné and I was shattered. But by the last 2 days, I remember saying to my sports director, can I pull out? Well, I never used to pull out a race, but can I pull out? I'm on my knees. And he's like, no, just try and carry on. So I pulled out the last day, when a lot of people do, because it's really hilly. But I was like, I'm done, you know, I really need a long break. And I remember them calling me up a little while later saying, can you do the Tour of Austria in July? And I was like, no, I'm shattered. Like, I need a bit more recovery before I do anything else. And then a little while later, they called up and said, can you do the Tour? I was like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, I'll be up for that.
And the team was split between Carlos Sastre and Tor Hushovd, wasn't it?
The division between the two of them, you say?
Well, two objectives for a smallish team with not huge resources. I mean, it must have been a lot of work to get through.
Yeah, it was. And Carlos did sort of almost uncharacteristically, I wouldn't say blow his lid, but in the last 3 days or 4 days of the Tour, I excuse him completely, because one of the things he brought up when he blew his lid was that, you know, I've won the Tour de France, and for the last week and a half I've spent a lot of time listening to riders talk about how they're going to get inside the time limit, which was true. You know, me and Andy Clear and whoever else spent quite a lot of time thinking, well, how are we going to get through today, you know, to get through to tomorrow. And there's some guy on the other end of the bus that's won the Tour de France thinking, well, probably deserve a little bit more support than this. So I kind of sympathise with Carlos, but he was a very calm-mannered person. But at the end of that Tour de France, I think he'd found it hard as well. You know, it's 2010, the Giro hadn't gone quite as well for him as he'd hoped to, and then the Tour was a bit of a disaster for him. You know, he's probably still top 20 somewhere. It was a bloody good ride, but
Have you been back with GCN and made like films around the Tour, being in the area where the team buses are, and seen the village since?
We've been to the Tour, yeah. We tend to go on the rest days because we can get a lot more access to riders and teams and mechanics and trucks and buses, etc. So I've never been back to the Champs-Élysées, as far as I know. But I've been back to the Tour. Like, when you, it feels bigger on the outside than it does on the inside, because you're quite protected as a rider. You go from the team hotel to the bus, which takes you to the start, and that's in a cordoned off zone, and then you go and sign on, and you go back to the bus, and you get to the start, and you get to the finish, and you get back on the bus, and that takes you to the hotel, and you're back inside a hotel again. And so, I don't know, you don't see the expanse of the Tour when you're inside it in the same way that you do when you're trying to follow it.
Do you sort of pinch yourself and think, I was one of those guys a few years ago?
Well, it felt like a dream to do it before I did it that would never materialise. And to be fair, it sort of, I remember starting the Tour and thinking, I'm going to soak up as much of this as I possibly can, because I think I knew at the time that it would be the only time I ever did it. But as I said, my memory's shit, and so I wish I'd written stuff down, because I'm sure I've forgotten loads of it. But I remember writing to Ian Boswell this year when he did the tour and texted him saying, make sure you sort of take some sort of diary. And at the time, I didn't realise he was doing an audio diary for you anyway, so he's got that forever. I said, make sure you keep a diary, because I'm sure Ian will do it again. You know, he's a much more talented writer, but I wish I'd kept some sort of written or audio diary at the time, because I'm sure most of it's drifted away from me.
When you were a kid, did you ever play Snakes and Ladders?
Yep.
Did you feel like your career was, you fought your way all the way up the ladders and then the snake just carries you straight back down and sort of half the time? Because I don't want to be unkind about it, but you said there about the tour being something you knew you wouldn't do again, but your career kind of came to quite an abrupt-ish end. But I guess you knew that, did you, because of the age you're at, or how did it feel at the time?
It felt sort of disheartening, and I didn't really know what I was going to do next. So I basically didn't get my contract renewed with Garmin Cervelo at the end of 2011, and it's a real, it's a massive sudden realization that actually there's something after cycling that you're going to have to do, because it doesn't matter how many people say you're going to need to get a job afterwards, make sure you've got something in place. I always think that if you, the point at which you really start thinking about that moment in life is the point at which you might as well quit anyway, because if you haven't got that tunnel vision and focus, it's sort of over, I think. And so I wasn't ready to finish, and all of a sudden it was like, Christ, you know, what am I going to do now, you know? And I was just fortunate, really, that I firstly got a few commentary gigs, and then Ian Whittingham from Sigma Sports said, well, why don't you race for us whilst you're doing commentary and videos? Because I'd started doing some videos for the company that would become GCN in 2012. So I was really, again, I ended up being really fortunate, because I had a transitional year, so I was still sort of racing, I would say, half-heartedly, because I just couldn't face going down a level to come back up. You know, some people can, like Russell Downing's very good at that. Ignatius Kanovalovas actually was another guy that sort of fell down that snake and made his way back up the ladder, and now he's a very well-respected domestique, but he was younger than me. I couldn't face my trajectory had always been upwards, and I couldn't face going downwards, and I was ready to get a job in the outside world. But I had this transitional year with IG Sigma Sport, commentary for Eurosport and for RCS Sport, and making videos with Shift Active Media, and I enjoyed doing that other side of things, and thankfully at the end of that year there was another sort of job waiting.
Did your career feel quite tenuous, quite insecure? I mean, by this point you had a young family and, you know, other people depending on you. So did it feel quite frightening to think, well, at least when I was riding a bike I could earn a living doing that. Now I've got to try and do a bit of this and a bit of that.
Well, it was tenuous, but I did have people relying on me, but my wife Lorraine was the main breadwinner, really. I mean, I had personal sponsors. So I had Barry Clark from Firkcroft Hotel, which turned into Collingwood, and he basically paid me through his business, so my earnings came through after tax. And then Nick Collins, who ran DFL Cycling News, he gave me 10 grand the year after he finished that team, just to, you know, just to enable me to carry on for another year to try and make it. And so without those sorts of people, you know, lots of cyclists, especially in the UK, seem to have a lot of funding from people that don't get much back. They're just fanatics that have got a little bit of money, and they choose to use that to help somebody on their way. So I didn't have, you know, Lorraine was doing really well in her job, and so from that point of view, you know, the funding was there.
What does she do?
She's an internal auditor, so she's still doing that to this day. So she was at House of Commons when I met her as an internal auditor, and she moved to Guildford University. So without her, and do you know what? I think if my dad died when I was 17, but I think if he'd been still alive when I was 27. Just got married and my wife was supporting me, he probably would have told me to pack it in, you know, go and get a proper job and support your family.
So what's it been like being in on the ground floor of one of the new media, cycling media sensation?
Well, it's just been an amazing experience, really. I started when GCN started in back end of 2012, and we launched at the start of 2013. None of us knew what we were doing. None of us knew where it would go. And I was a terrible presenter, but we had no audience and no expectation and nothing to compare ourselves to. So we could kind of organically, probably a bit like you when you started a podcast. I imagine if you listened to the first podcast you ever did, you kind of think, well, Christ, I sound terrible. And I look, I mean,
The improvements have been negligible.
The problem is that because it's a digital age, they're still there. And so I quite regularly get sent the first video I ever did. And when we take a new presenter on, I normally send it to them because they think, well, I'm not very good at presenting. I was like, well, you are. Take a look at this. This is bad presenting. And so we were just in this privileged position, myself and Cy Richardson and later Matt and Tom Last, where we could kind of organically grow because there was no expectation on us and we could do what we wanted and get better through practice, really. But it's been amazing, you know. We've sort of grown steadily, but largely over the years to this point where we've, you know, now got 1.5 million subscribers and a lot of people watch videos every day. And it's much more normal now, but it's very different to how it was.
How do you deal with the feedback? And what kind of feedback do you get?
Same as yourselves, I'd imagine. Like, largely positive, and then a few negative, which is the ones that you focus right in on.
They're the ones that keep you awake an hour late at night and wake you up an hour early in the morning, in my experience.
I mean, this is something I've spoken to you about over the years, that you always focus on the negative comments. Even if there's 99 positive ones and one negative, that's the one, like you said, that you sort of dwell on. And actually you shouldn't, because, you know, people are less likely to write a positive comment if they like something than write a negative one if they've disliked it. And you're never ever going to please everybody.
The worst negative comments are the ones that have got a grain of truth, though. And at least you can turn those into a positive and think, well, you've got a point there, I can maybe improve.
Yeah, and we've always taken all comments on board. Like, we've always tried to be a channel where you kind of engage people and they feel like they're a part of what you're doing. So rather than talking to them, you kind of talk with them, which I think is what you do very well as well. And I think people feel like they know you. And so whenever somebody recognises me at a cycling event, they often sort of say, oh, Dan. And it's only after they say Dan that they realise I don't know who they are. And that's a lovely thing to have, because they obviously feel like they know you well enough through the way that you've presented and gone through videos, that they feel like you're a friend, even though they don't know you face to face. And that's really nice feedback to have.
Do you feel like the audience has come on a journey with you? I mean, I know you've got a lot of, as we say in the industry, evergreen content about, you know, that the how and the why and the, you know, the basics of bike riding, and but you've kind of evolved beyond that, certainly in the last 18 months or so, I'd say. Do you feel like you've brought people on a bit of a journey?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, there's so many people that come up to you and say, I didn't know anything about cycling, and then I got your YouTube videos and they sort of taught me how to do this and I ended up achieving this. And that's an amazing sort of feedback to have. Like, you know, you've helped these people to pick up a bike, start from scratch, and quite quickly progress to being able to do 100 miles at this big charity event or whatever it might be. And that's a really nice feeling, because, you know, when I first started doing it and I was doing videos about how to mend a puncture, and you sort of feel like it's quite demeaning, like how, you know, everyone knows how to fix a puncture, but actually we all have to learn everything in cycling at the beginning, and it's not an embarrassment to say that you don't know that. But there wasn't the sort of, you know, you had magazines, but unless you bought a whole archive of magazines, you had to wait for the next time someone wrote that article. Whereas with, you know, the beauty of having a YouTube channel is that they're there all the time. So if people want to know how to fix a puncture, or how to go up climbs faster, or how to lose weight, or how to change gears. You know, I remember someone suggesting we should do a video on how to change gears. I'm not doing... It's plainly obvious how you change gears, and it's one of our most successful videos ever, because...
Yeah, but that's because a lot of people are trying to change gears when they're out the saddle or on a climb, yeah. Or, you know, change before you go into a climb or before you go into a corner or whatever. Things that you kind of take for granted. I think there's an awful lot about cycling that becomes exclusive in terms of people hold their knowledge over others. Oh, did you not know that? You know, people are kind of almost embarrassed to be beginners. And one of the things about some of those videos is that, well, we all have to start somewhere, and so they're kind of inclusive. I guess that is, you know, pretty much the whole point.
Yeah, well, there's a snobbishness about cycling in some ways, isn't there? And I've been guilty of that in the past as well. You know, in my competitive sense, I remember when you'd be on a, you know, an established Sunday group ride, and if someone new turned up, my outlet would not be, oh, let's welcome it. My outlet would be, I'll show them how to ride a bike up the first climb of the day. And then when they were dropped, I felt this sense of satisfaction, like, yeah. But it's just awful, isn't it? And now our ethos is it should be much more inclusive, and there shouldn't be this snobbishness of you're not allowed to wear this kit, or your socks are too short, or whatever it might be. You know, people riding bikes is a great thing.
I still remember the sense of pride I had when I adequately pointed out a parked car with the hand gesture behind my back, or, you know, pointed out a pothole with a point down to the ground, and, you know, everyone gets around the obstacle safely. I've ridden in groups in the last 10 years where nobody's pointing anything out. It really is like you're on your own, and the number of times you hit a pothole and you're cursing the people in front. but I guess because they kind of don't know. A lot of me kind of, I think, look back at those years of the group ride, the club ride, and thinking, God, it was quite stuffy and very rules orientated. But if you kind of completely throw out all of those rules, you lose something as well. You know, the essence of the group ride has kind of gone out of cycling a bit, with everyone now riding to however many watts or however many hours they need to do.
Yeah, and so I think we, you know, as G said, we've kind of got this responsibility to encourage people into the sport, but also to teach them how to ride. Because I mean, I sometimes when I'm in my car, I get immensely frustrated behind a group of cyclists, because they obviously haven't been taught how to ride, and you've got, you know, seven people, one of them is sort of near the central white line somewhere, allowing nobody to try and pass them or whatever, and you kind of feel like you get frustrated with them because you realise that they are frustrating vehicles. So this sort of, you know, animosity between people that drive cars and people that ride bikes increases because people aren't being taught how to ride a bike in a, you know, polite way, for want of a better word, out on the open road. And I think we've got a sort of degree of responsibility to teach that without sort of doing it in a way that's discouraging and seems elitist and snobbish and you're not doing things the right way. But, you know, we've got that problem at the moment, you know, the division between car drivers and cyclists, which is the more cyclists there are on the road, the bigger it becomes.
That's a whole other subject that we haven't got time for in this podcast, but maybe in a future one. I do want to finish up by just asking I don't know whether you'll want to answer this one, but what percentage of your income per year is betting winnings?
Is what, sorry?
What percentage of your income a year is betting winnings?
Oh, I see. Well, not much. So I will tell you that I never bet when I was a cyclist, because I didn't know anything about it. And then when I finished, I don't know why I did start, but I sort of started looking at odds for some reason. And it was just like a replacement for my obsession with numbers on cycling. I used to look at odds and think, well, those are bloody good odds for somebody that actually can win. And the nice thing about cycling is that you, like, unlike horse racing, where if you've got a 50-1 horse, they've got no chance pretty much of winning. Like, once in a blue moon, they might come through first. Whereas in cycling, you can have someone that's 300-1, and actually they've got a decent chance of winning. And I've had quite a few sort of 300-1 moments, like Steve Cummings winning his first stage of the tour, where, you know, you've put a fiver on and you've got 1,500 quid back. But my ethos has always been long shot, so you can go through quite long periods where you win nothing for months and you think, well, actually, this really is a monk's game. You know, I'm wasting my money here. But the ethos of having long odds means that you only need to have one win in a blue moon and you end up doing all right.
I have had some nice wins, though, in cycling. I famously backed Floyd Landis to win the 2006 Tour de France, cashed out before he got officially done.
Well, that's a nice feeling, isn't it? I mean, I had money, as did Freeber, actually, on Stephen Kreis' bike to win the Giro d'Italia. I think it was like 125-1 the year that he was winning it. And I'd put a fiver each way on, so about 800 quid profitable returns. And it came to the point where it looked like he was almost guaranteed to win it, and the cash-out price was about 580 quid out of the possible 800. And I thought, well, he's guaranteed, you know, and Daniel, I think he left his bet on, but I just got nervous one night. I was like, well, anything can happen in cycling. So the night before he crashed into the snow, I was there on my computer. I was like, I just pressed the button. I was like, no, cash out. I immediately regretted it after. I was like, well, that's stupid. I've lost out on 220 quid here. And the next day, he ploughed into a snowball. And I got a text from Daniel, like, did you cash out? And I said, yeah. He said, you bastard.
Well, I think that will conclude the cycling podcast with Dan Lloyd, Dinner with Dan Lloyd. We should get a little somewhere, whether you do it on GCN or maybe on the cycling podcast, a little betting corner, and people can match your wins and losses over the season. It'd be fascinating to know how, whether you're up or whether you're down over a whole season.
Well, I don't want to be contrary, but I don't think we should encourage betting. It's a sort of downward spiral, isn't it? But we should do it again. Liquid lunch with Lionel and Lloydy.
Let's do that. In the meantime, Daniel, thank you.
Pleasure. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.